Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we're going to talk with Ellen Brown, who is the president of the Public Banking Institute, and she's also the author of 12 books, most notably her best-selling book, The Web of Debt, and her most recent book, The Public Banking Solution. This show is pretty interesting as far as coming up with a solution that can help with our public debt. It can help with our loan problem for small businesses. It can help reduce the cost of city projects and state projects, and it can really help stimulate the local economies and help them flourish. North Dakota is an example of, well, the only example in our country of a state that has a public banking system. But what's interesting is during the crisis in 2008-2009, they are the only state in the union that did not go in the red. And people are going to claim it's the oil boom that caused that, but no, it was before the oil boom. So it really ties back to this public banking solution. So it'll be really interesting to talk to Ellen Brown about what that is and how that could help us. Next, we're going to be talking to the CEO of FlexWage, which is a company that has a patented solution for providing employee pay on a daily basis. The concept is there to significantly reduce payday loans and alternate financing options that people who have cash flow problems have to resort to. The problem with that, with the problem with payday loans and some of this alternative financing that people are doing, is that they are paying absolutely astronomical interest rates between 500% and even up to like 1500%. Those are the people that can least afford to pay those kind of interest rates, and they are getting taken advantage of because these companies can do it, and these people are desperate to be able to pay their bills, to eat, to do the things they need to do. So this flex wage solution really is a unique patented way to alleviate some of those needs that these people have. So first, we're going to welcome Ellen Brown to the show. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Oh, great to be on your show. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. First, I want to start because you have so much background and so much that you've been doing in the banking industry. And I want to start by asking you what your organization is. What is the Public Banking Institute?
Well, it's actually a volunteer organization. I wrote a book called Web of Debt and published it in 2007, and I sort of predicted that things were going to fall apart, and they did then in 2008. And then I knew that there was one state that had its own bank, North Dakota. And so I was watching it, and at first there were four states that stayed in the black, and then there were three, and then there were two, and then there was one. North Dakota was the only state that escaped the credit crisis, and that was in the spring of 2009 before they had the big oil boom and stuff. So there was a comedy show. There's a comedy show where it was all about what explains North Dakota's wealth when everybody else is broke. And he said they were seducing, visitors to come up there, and then they were stealing their money.
Oh.
Anyway.
Well, you know,
it wasn't obvious at that time. So then I started writing about it and about their model and why that worked and how that allowed them to not only not be victims of this whole Wall Street thing, but they could leverage their own funds, their own public monies for the local community, and that this has done great things for the local community.
Well, I think we're lucky that we have something we can look at.
Yeah, we're lucky we have one.
Well,
globally, it turns out that globally, 40% of banks are publicly owned. I only learned that. I mean, it's not something you learn in school. It was when people started challenging North Dakota and said, well, this is like several years later. They said, well, they've got oil and stuff. So I thought, well, I better find some other models. And sure enough, there were a ton of models. And these 40% are largely in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which all escaped the credit crisis, at least initially, plus things like Germany, which has a strong public banking sector, and Japan and Korea, countries like that.
Okay.
So anyway, in 2009, I started writing, 2008, I started writing on the Bank of North Dakota, and then I got so much email I couldn't answer it. So a friend said, well, why don't you set up a Google group, and then they can talk to each other. And you don't
have to answer. Oh, because that's how it started, so you didn't have to get inundated with so much stuff. Well,
yeah, and then that turned, eventually we felt like we, after a couple of years, we got some really big heavy hitters in that Google group that actually knew a lot about banking and, you know, some actual bankers. There was one woman who worked for the Federal Reserve. And after a couple of years, we felt like we understood not only what went wrong, but how it could be fixed. And so we thought we needed to get out there and do something. So we formed an institute for the purpose just of spreading information. I mean, it's not a political action group. It's just, we're just out there.
But you
trying
guys have
to get this idea out there.
You have a realistic solution for our debt problem. And I would, before we get into, more what your solution is, what is our problem? I think you have to identify what, you know, what is our problem? What's going on right now? Why do you think the source of the problem is?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have sort of a parasitic model of banking. So all of our money is created by banks. All of our circulating money supply, except for coins, is created by banks in the form of loans, including the Federal Reserve, which is a bank, and they don't. Most people think that the government issues the money. I mean, if you ask people, they look at the dollar bill or the coins and they see pictures of the president.
The government's supposed to be issuing the money according to our Constitution, right?
You would think, yeah. Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. That's what it says. They always argue about what the word coin means. But in fact, and in the 19th century, it was about 50-50. It was like half coins and half paper money issued by banks.
It was a different time. Coins had so much more value.
Exactly.
And so it's just not, yeah. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, so gradually over time, the banking system just sort of took over the field. And so now all of our money, except coins, is created by banks. When a bank makes a loan, it actually creates a deposit on its books. People think, I just wrote an article on this, it's sort of a fine point. You would think nobody cares about it except economists and bankers. But I got more comments on this article. I mean, I got like, I think 178 comments on Seeking Alpha. And anyway, I got a lot of comments on it because it's obscure, but it's the difference between whether banks are taking in existing money and lending it out, or whether they create the money they lend, and then they back that loan. When they have to clear their checks, they do need the deposits. They get the deposits back in to balance their books. But where did those deposits come from? They are initially created by banks. So it's sort of like a check-kiting scheme, you know, where a check-kiting is where you write a check on a... You don't have anything in your account, but you write a check to another account. And before the check bounces, you manage to collect some money. Or something. I don't remember exactly how they do it. But it's where, so in this case, the bank creates the money as a loan. Let's say it's a loan to buy a house, and you write a check to your seller, and that check goes into the seller's bank. Now the first bank has to balance its books. And it doesn't have the deposits, let's say, so it can borrow the deposits. So it borrows the deposits from the bank that just got the check that it just created. So it borrows those deposits back at the Fed funds rate of 0.25%.
So that's how they borrow, but they borrow it from the same bank that they just gave it the money to?
Well, not necessarily, but just picture this over the whole.
Yeah, or they borrow it from whatever bank.
It's all one system, and they all have access to this great pool of money. And that's the benefit of being a bank. And that's why if you're a public entity, you're much better off being a bank than being a revolving fund, you know, where you just lend out your money and wait till it comes back, or you just spend your money, or you have to tax it before you have it. If you're a bank, you can put your money in the bank, then you can create money as loans, but that money you put in the bank is still there. And you might say, well, how could that be? Because you just created it as a loan. It's the way it works is that if the borrower and the depositor come for their money at the same time, the bank just borrows it from another bank, and arguably another bank where that check just got deposited.
And they, and the Federal Reserve is the ultimate lender, right? So if, does it all kind of funnel back to them?
Right. Well, if they're the, like the reserves. So if, and it, well, in 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed, before that, you had all these bank runs all the time. The bank were always, they were always issuing too many checks or too many bank notes against the amount of gold they had. And periodically, people would figure that out, and there'd be a run in the banks, and there'd be a crisis, and the economy would crash, and people would lose their homes. And, you know, it's quite a, I think it was something like once every 6 years, they had a banking crisis in the 19th century. So in 1913, they came up with this system where the Federal Reserve would backstop all that. So that, but in the new system, you couldn't just issue banknotes willy-nilly. You had to balance, you had to run everything through the Federal Reserve. So in order to clear your checks, if your books don't balance, if you don't have as much coming in as going out, then the Federal Reserve counts that as an overdraft on your Federal Reserve account. So in order to clear that overdraft, then you borrow from somewhere. So you can borrow from another bank, you can borrow from the money market, maybe you get in CDs or different ways to do it.
So what is the problem with that? What is the problem with the Federal Reserve being around? Because it sounds like it's a much better system than having crashes every 6 years, having runs on banks.
It is, but the problem is the Federal Reserve is actually composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district. The biggest, clearly, is the New York Federal Reserve, so they pretty much call the shots on what the Federal Reserve Board does. So now, for example, we have quantitative easing to the tune of several trillion dollars, but where has that money gone? It's never gotten past Wall Street. What if it were a real public central bank, which has happened before historically, like in Canada, New Zealand, other places, they've had real central banks that were owned by the government, then they would use that credit to stimulate jobs. You know, they would hire people, build infrastructure, hire more teachers, all the things that government needs to do. They would make loans.
The money would be available to the people. Instead
right.
of just
but
to,
instead, but it's only available to the bankers, and what do they use it for? They speculate with it.
Well, what, who owns the Federal Reserve?
Well, the Federal Reserve branches are all owned by the banks in their district. So in New York, for example, I think there are about 500 banks that are member banks. But the Federal Reserve Board, that's where it gets a little confusing because appointed by the president, confirmed by Congress, et cetera. So there is a government element to that, but they all march to the drummers of Wall Street. And you know, there have been a lot of articles lately about how corrupt it is.
Well, and tell me if I'm wrong, the people who are appointed to the board are very much, I mean, there's a big lobby to get the people who are very connected with the bankers or the bankers that, I mean, they pretty much get the people they want. The bankers get the people they want on the board.
Well, it's true. I mean, they've always been bankers themselves until recently. Ben Bernanke was a professor, and Janet Yellen was not a banker. I mean, she's a professor too. But they still listen to the big banks. I mean, that's just the way it works. There's a whole Federal Reserve Board, and they, it's designed to, their mandate is to maintain the stability of the currency, which basically means don't let any extra money out there, because supposedly that would be inflationary, but it wouldn't. We're actually in deflation, meaning there's not enough money out there. in if there were more money out there, people would have the money to spend. I mean, what I think they should do is they can do quantitative easing, but do $1 trillion and drop it into people's checking accounts. I mean, you could there in Switzerland, wow. There's actually a bill on to do that.
Where well, for the amount of money they did with quantitative easing, tell me if I'm wrong, we would have been able to wipe out people's mortgages. I mean, we would have just been, right?
Yeah, we could have. Well, you could have fixed a lot of it, yeah. Or you could, student debt is $1 trillion now. So you could do $1 trillion quantitative easing, which is what the first couple were, and buy up all the student debt and rip it up. And it wouldn't affect anything. I mean, you wouldn't hurt the lenders because you're going to actually buy it up from the lenders. So they're going to get paid. And then it'll be the Federal Reserve that holds it, and they can just hang on to it. They don't have to do anything with it. Don't, you know.
You cut out there for a second, but I think you're back. Then a lot of people would be, it would just be a nice thing for people. Everybody, the whole country would be able to move forward and really make a big difference. There's a lot of different things they could have done, but there's a lot of, How many big banks would you say are the bigger influences with the Federal Reserve? Is it really kind of narrowed down to just like 5 or 6 banks that really have the most influence? And do they work together? And are those banks then owned by a small number of families?
It is 5 or 6 banks, and I don't remember the exact figure, but I think they have like 60% of the banking assets in the country, 5 or 6 banks.
And then they own
a lot of it is derivatives. They now are making their money in derivatives rather. They're not making small business loans anymore. That's another reason we're pushing public banking, because it's only the state and local and city governments that care about local business anymore. And they're the ones, that's where the jobs come from.
Well, I was reading about the North Dakota Bank, and they're giving out, there's more banks in North Dakota, and they give out something like 3 times the small business loans than other banks, because the other banks just can't do it because they have to pay such a high percentage, and it's too expensive, and it just doesn't work very well their cost of money is 2% higher the way the Federal Reserve is set up than the big banks.
Right. Well, the problem is they have to compete for deposits, because there are new regulations that say in order to clear their checks, they can't borrow from the other banks. They have to have, a big percentage of it has to be their own depositors, which means their own customers. Well, if they don't, just think about it. Who's got most of the business? Who's got most of the depositors? It's Bank of America and Chase, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or U.S. Bank. You know, the big names that you know. And so the little banks have to advertise, and they have to put up extra branches. And I mean, they really have to scramble to get this business in. So that's a cost that the big banks don't have. I mean, they're already there raking in the deposits. And all the state and local governments put their money with the big banks because the little banks can't handle it. They have to post 110% in collateral. So taking public deposits doesn't do them any good.
So there would be, if we did a public bank like North Dakota, and that went across all the different states, that could potentially, how would it wipe out our debt? If we already have the debt. How would we be able to implement it? Do you know what I mean? If we one by one created these banks in each state, what would happen to the Federal Reserve and to the debt that's already sitting there?
Well, those are two different issues. Public banks are at a local level. And the reason we're aiming for the public banks is that, I mean, the public state and local banks is that Congress is pretty much deadlocked. There's no way that we, the little people, are going to affect what the Federal Reserve does, probably. But you can approach your local legislators, and we've done it. I mean, we've got 20 bills pending for state-owned banks. They had none of them has actually passed, so that's why we're now working on the city and county legislators. And they're very receptive, and they know their local problems. So they know that their businesses aren't able to get loans, and that's why they're not, that's why their schools are closing, et cetera, because of these big debts. So the way that a public bank would serve a local government, first of all, if you own the bank, over the course of a 30-year bond issue, you're going to pay as much in interest as you pay in principal. So if you borrowed that money from instead from your own bank and you get that interest back, you're going to save 50% on the cost of infrastructure. So in California, for example, we have a $700 billion infrastructure bill coming due over the next 10 years. I mean, that's how much infrastructure we need. We don't have the money. So it's going to be twice that if we have to borrow the money. If we can borrow it from ourselves and keep the interest, we cut the cost in half.
Yeah, because you don't, the interest doesn't go anywhere but back to the city or back to the government.
Right, or the Bay
State
Bridge.
Or whatever.
The Bay Bridge thing that they just finished, you know, that looks really good in San Francisco. I don't know, where are you?
I'm in Minnesota.
Oh, yeah, I thought you had, I recognized that accent.
Do I have an accent?
Well, just, you know, only to me. I probably have one to you, but I'm from Los Angeles.
Oh, that's funny.
Or I'm in Los Angeles, yeah.
Do I sound like Do I sound like the movie Fargo?
Yeah, you sound a little bit like North Dakota. That's what I was thinking.
Oh, that's funny.
Just a little bit. Excuse me. So in San Francisco, they just finished this retrofit on the bridge, you know, made this really nice new section. It was supposed to be $6 billion, but by the time you do interest, it's going to be $12 billion. The bullet train.
Woo, everybody wants to pay twice as much.
Yeah. So anyway, bullet trains, same thing, it'll be double with interest. The Delta water tunnels are even more than double with interest. So there's all these precedents to show how much you can save.
Okay, so if these states, how much are other banks in North Dakota, or like as Wells Fargo and some of these big banks in North Dakota as well, or do they pretty much stay away from North Dakota?
Well, they have a smaller presence than anywhere else. They're being squeezed out by the local banks.
Okay, and so the local banks all work with the public bank in North Dakota.
Right. So the Bank of North Dakota will put up the money, or you know, the local bank is like the front office. The Bank of North Dakota doesn't, they do a few direct loans, but mostly they work with these local banks.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really have to do much in the way of front office banking. They only have one branch right there in the capital city. They don't do ATMs, et cetera. They do have a few individual depositors just because they feel like they should, but mostly they are the state's own bank. So it's the state's own revenues that are their deposits.
So
the local bank will go out and find the public project that needs to be done, you know, whatever, a business, a farm or whatever that needs funding. And then, normally the local banks just can only do small projects, but if the state bank partners with them, the state bank can put up 90% of the money. They can guarantee the loan so you don't have to worry about your capital requirement. And they can make much bigger loans than they could otherwise. So it's a very nice partnership there.
Well, let's imagine that we can get more of these states in line. How would the Federal Reserve, I mean, would we make the Federal Reserve obsolete, or would there still be a role for the Federal Reserve if every state bank, you know, if there was public banks in every state?
Well, there would still be a role because Bank of North Dakota uses the Federal Reserve's window like everybody else. I mean, if you need extra liquidity, that's where you get it. Or I think they first go to the Federal Home Loan Board. There are a number of these sort of bankers' banks out there that you can get your liquidity from.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So it's a good thing to have a central bank. I mean, it's just the backstop for this whole system. But the problem is that they say they're an independent central bank, which basically means they're independent of government, which means they're independent of us, but they're not independent of Wall Street. It's Wall Street.
It's Wall Street's bank.
Yeah. So if it were our bank, if it were a government bank, it would be ideal.
Well, what do you think about auditing the Federal Reserve? Because I know that they had one audit and everybody was pretty much really kind of upset with the $16 trillion that they loaned out all over the place.
Yeah, and it was really hard to get that audit, too. So who knows what else they're up to. But, yeah, definitely it should be totally transparent, totally accountable, and that's the way the Bank of North Dakota is. So it's sort of the central bank for North Dakota. And they are audited several different ways, and they're very proud of the fact that all their books are totally open for anybody to see.
Why do you think people aren't mad? Because it's just so amazing. There's so few people that, well, I want you to answer this. Why do you think people aren't mad once that audit went forward and $16 trillion was loaned out in our name that we have to pay taxes on without a congressional approval, and the average person isn't mad?
Well, I think the average person, I mean, I just think about my own relatives. I mean, they're busy. They're way too busy. They've got to work. They come home. They're tired. They turn on the TV. You know, they really think that banking is too obscure for them. And so some people read the internet and they read these shocking things, but then they think, well, there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, what are they going to do? We did have the Occupy movement, which is pretty impressive that people got out in the streets. But another thing, the Fed actually, that was not taxpayer money. The Fed has the power to create money on their books. So what they did, those were actually short-term overnight loans. So really they were just providing the liquidity for the banking system.
And so that won't turn into debt on us?
No, huh? Those are paid back.
Yeah. Okay, so it's all paid back and it didn't increase
our debt.
Yeah,
but if they can do $16 trillion for the banks, why can't they do $16 trillion for the states? And look at all the infrastructure we need.
Woo-hoo, I know. We have some serious issues. Why are we not using the resources that we have to really solve our problems? Why are we just propping up the banks and making them wealthy? Because aren't they loaning at 0% and then they turn around and, I mean, they're just making killing on that.
Yeah. So they could do just one quantitative easing would be enough to drop $1,000 into the bank accounts of everyone. Or let's say you did everyone who was in the lower 95% or something like that. I forget what the figures were, but maybe it was in the lower 80%. Anyway, you could do $1,000 a month for everyone would be like one round of quantitative easing.
I think if they could just wipe out some debt. I mean, I think
that would be monthly. So that would be monthly. In other words, you'd have a stipend to, it'd be like getting Social Security before you're 65, but it would give everybody security.
Yeah, it would give people security. But wouldn't you think if we could just, because we have so much debt, if we could just, I mean, we're almost bankrupt as a country. Would you agree with that? When I say we're almost bankrupt as a country, is that a true statement in your opinion?
To look at it, we're bankrupt if Congress keeps imposing a debt ceiling and doesn't allow them to go further into debt. But in fact, because all money is debt, that's where it comes from. It all comes from banks that create it as a debt. If you didn't have a $16 trillion debt, you wouldn't have a $16 trillion money supply. In other words, our debt is our money supply. So it's really a bookkeeping thing, and we don't need to be frightened of that debt. What they should do is just acknowledge that was just printed money. It's never going to get paid back. But the thing is, we're paying interest on it to the Chinese and the Japanese.
Why are we doing that? That doesn't make sense.
We should borrow it from our own central bank, which we own. And, you know, because they have the power to create money. And we get the interest back, or don't even bother to pay interest. But what they should do, I think, they could do this gradually and it wouldn't shake the system or anything. Just say, all right, we're not going to issue any more debt. When these bonds come in, we're just going to issue the money directly that we need, we the government. So when the bonds come in, like the Chinese bonds they mature, you know, so they're due, you know, how they buy bonds,
yeah,
where they pay like a certain percentage less than the face value of the bond. And then when it's due, they get the face value back. So when they come due, you just pay the things off. And then when they go to roll it over, which is what they normally do, just say, sorry, we're not selling any more bonds. So, I mean, you can't just
They could slowly become independent from the Chinese and from the...
Yeah, you can't just say we're going to just cancel the debt, because that's a default, and that means that means the Chinese are going to actually lose out, which is not fair. But you can pay off the bonds and not renew them, and just gradually say we're not going to do debt anymore. From henceforth, we're issuing the money directly, we the people, and it'll be out there as cash, and you know, it won't bear interest.
People are talking about the dollar's going to collapse and things like that. Do you think the dollar could collapse?
No. I don't think that's a problem.
You don't think that? Why do they say it, and why do you think it's not a problem?
Well, they say it will collapse for that reason, that at some point the Chinese will quit lending to us. Well, we don't need the Chinese to lend to us. We sort of do that as a favor. Like they have all these dollars and they don't know what to do with them. And we say, fine, buy our bonds with them. You know, it's a way to keep them quiet over there while we're buying their products off them.
Just recently, I read something that Alan Greenspan suggested that people start buying gold. Do you think gold is something that people should buy as an investment?
Well, as an investment is a different thing than I don't think you really need it for if the dollar collapses, because I don't think the dollar is going to collapse. But gold might go up. I mean, it's pretty low right now. So in that sense, it might not be a bad investment.
But you don't see it as a hedge against the dollar or anything like that, because it's just not, you just don't see the dollar being a problem. So gold, if you want to invest in gold, that's fine, but it's a totally separate issue.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay.
But it doesn't hurt to have some, I mean, aside from the dollar collapsing, what could happen? We well could have a banking crisis like we had in 2008, but that's not a collapse of the dollar. That's a collapse of the banking system. So it could be that you go to the bank and the door's closed and you can't get your money out. So it doesn't hurt to have some gold or some cash, you know, sitting in your vault somewhere, or just some form of liquidity in case that happens.
Do you foresee that happening in the near future? Because there's a lot of you know, the websites and the people talking that's something that could happen. Do you foresee that?
Yeah, I think that could happen. I mean, it certainly happened in 2008.
It's sure.
Not at all beyond the realm of possibility. And, or if you think about what Roosevelt did, when that was a big banking crisis and all the banks were going bankrupt. So they didn't have the money. People were running to the banks to try to get their money out. That was when they were on the gold standard. So Roosevelt just closed all the banks, declared a banking holiday, and said, fine, we can fix this. We'll take the dollar off the gold standard. In other words, your paper money no longer represents gold. It just represents reserves. And that actually worked. So that's what they always do when there's a crisis. They change the system. And that's what I hopefully they'll change it to something sustainable this time. I just wrote an article, which I haven't posted yet, that we've changed our system every 20 or 30 years for the last 300 years. I mean, what we call money has changed every 20 or 30 years. So this time when it collapses, what they should do, I doubt it will because they're in the control of the banks, but what they should do is nationalize the banks. Say, fine, we acknowledge that you're too big to fail and we can't live without you. We need your credit, but we're not going to let you make off like a bandit with the profits again while we bear the losses. We're going to take charge here and we're going to use your banking system for the purposes of the people who are floating this banking system. I mean, they should do a whole overhaul of the system. And there is a way that they could make it all sustainable, and that's what I read about.
Do you think it's possible that they would? Is there too much politics to keep that from happening?
Well, the big banks are getting more and more of a bad rep. Rep. Anyway, people don't like them anymore, so it could well be. I don't see any new Roosevelts popping up. I mean, it seems like
we don't have any major. We don't have any leaders right now. But anyways, keep going.
Yeah. But that's what it would take. I mean, the last time we had a real leader was probably Kennedy, and he got shot, obviously. I mean, they don't allow anybody to be that much of a...
And are you saying they? Are you talking about the banking, the people who own the banks?
Do you know Catherine Austin Fitz? She's pretty interesting.
I don't know, but I'm going to learn about her now.
Yeah, she's one of your gold bugs. But she was assistant director of HUD, the Housing and Urban Development, under the first Reagan, and she started looking into, there was all this missing money you know, trillions of dollars that had just gone missing, the black budget. And so she was just looking into the figures, you know, figuring out where they went, and started writing about it. And all of a sudden she was blacklisted. She lost her job.
She dug into something she wasn't supposed to learn about.
All right. Well, so her latest thing now, she says it's extraterrestrials.
Oh,
so who knows? I mean, well, there's this huge black budget thing going on, and nobody really knows who it is. It's definitely not the president. I mean, Clinton and different presidents have said, they don't tell me. You know, I can't go there. I'm not in control of that.
You mean the president doesn't get to see the black budget?
Right. There are things that are too classified for the president to see.
Well, how could that be? Because
nobody knows.
The Congress and our Constitution, there isn't anything that should be too classified for the president, right?
Well, they've changed an awful lot of the rules of the Constitution of late. I'm not sure we have our constitutional protections anymore.
So there's this big black budget, huh? And what is this? Just interesting. So
yeah, it's probably as big as the regular budget. That's why, I mean, that's where half our taxes go to. Well, half our taxes go to the military, and a lot of that is black budget.
Well, how much of the Federal Reserve stuff helps the black budget?
I don't know exactly, but. Yeah, I actually recommend listening to Catherine Austin Fitz because she's delved into it and she's got a lot of interesting figures.
Yeah, I'll look into it. How do they know there's a black? I mean, she ran into it, but how do other people? How can you verify that what she's saying is accurate? Is there so much information out there that really says, yeah, this is accurate?
Yeah, well, I was going to interview a man today for my radio show who is the former defense minister of Canada. And he's just written a book where he talked a lot about the black budget and also about the extraterrestrial influence. It's something that, you know, it's a big secret that we're not told about.
But the aliens. There's an alien. They're saying that there's an alien influence over our thing. Do you believe in that? Is it something that you've seen yourself?
Oh, I haven't seen it, but I, you know, I'm a writer, so of course I find all this keenly interesting.
Oh yeah, it is kind of interesting. Woohoo! It's hard to like go there unless you've actually seen it yourself or something, and it makes sense that there could be, but it's just so hard to make that mental leap. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but if you do a lot of research, I mean, there's so much evidence now. There are a number of disclosure projects that just have, I mean, it should just watch a few of those videos. Watch the disclosure project videos. Those are pretty compelling.
What's it called? Disclosure?
Disclosure project, yeah. There are all kinds of military people that have seen these things and
I have watched a lot of that stuff because I'm interested in all that stuff anyways, but I don't know if I want to go on record saying that I'm into conspiracies.
Yeah. Well,
but it sure is interesting.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. If you say, who is pulling the strings? People always ask me that. Who's pulling the strings? Well, who knows? It is the black budget. It's not the president. It's not Congress. It's somebody else. So
Who is it?
Right.
And if the what does the president do if they're not pulling strings? What are they doing? They're just standing around? I mean, they're busy going to meetings?
I think their strings are pulled.
Do they?
I don't think anybody gets to be president anymore unless they've been thoroughly vetted. Or here's what I actually think happens. They take you into a little room after you get elected. And they say, this is how it is. We have your wife and kids here.
I saw this thing that there's this black pope, too. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Well, that's probably way out there. it's fascinating. Oh, how interesting is that? But I would really like to get her information. Yeah, I'll talk to her, see what that's about. But reason I brought you on is because my show is about, you know, business game changers, and I think your public banking philosophy and the things that you're talking about with public banking can really help small businesses. And it's a solution. I know small businesses in this country, it's at the lowest level it's been in history. And the startups, shall I say. And this is a solution to just really solve so many of our problems.
Yeah, agreed. It can, they can, our problems can be solved. It's a matter of, it's a political problem. It's a matter of political understand, or political will. And to get that, first of all, you have to have political understanding. It's not like a real easy issue. You could just bring an initiative and make the government do it, make your local government do it. But people don't understand it. So it's not like going into the supermarket with a little clipboard and say, do you want to sign my proposal or my initiative for against abortion or for gay marriage or something like that. It's, if you say, do you want to, will you sign my initiative for a public bank or a state-owned bank? They'll say, I don't trust the state. I don't trust banks. We've already got too many banks or something. They just don't know what you're talking about. So that's the first problem, is breaking through this ignorance that is intentionally imposed by the media, which are owned by those same families that own the banks. In order to, you know, shed light on what's really going on here and the fact that we can fix this problem. And then the other problem is, unless you do it by an initiative, would be to get the power. In other words, you're going to be up against those big lobbyists from the big banks, and they've got more money than we do. They can advertise and we can't, and all that stuff.
Well, I mean, there's so much facts that doing what North Dakota did has been absolutely wonderful. At this point, it just seems like there's big powers that are keeping it from happening, because why would not, I mean, how many states are seriously looking at doing this?
20 have bills of one sort or another, but I've kind of lost hope on this. Well, I shouldn't say that. I'm actually working with the California controller and a U.S. representative from here on a state bank SBA project. So it's possible, but that where it seems to me where you could do it without meeting so much resistance would be a city. For example, Philadelphia has a movement. Santa Fe has a movement. And like the Santa Fe mayor is actually pushing for a city-owned bank. And that's just a little local community. The city of Santa Fe probably isn't a whole lot smaller than the bank, than North Dakota. Or Philadelphia is probably the same size as North Dakota. I don't know. 670,000 people in North Dakota.
What are their solutions? Everybody knows that small, I shouldn't say everyone, but most people know, and all the facts are out there, that small businesses are struggling. Jobs, there isn't jobs. People know that small businesses create the jobs. It's just out there, all these facts. What are their solutions if it's not something like this?
Yeah, well, that's why it's a very, once they get it, it's very appealing to legislators.
Once again, if they're, and most legislators want to do the right thing, right? They want to do what's good for their communities.
Yeah, if nothing else, they want to get reelected, and they have to appeal to their constituents.
Yeah, so I think having the North Dakota model, I think North Dakota now with all the oil boom that they have, people can just say, well, that's because of their oil. And so politically, that's kind of a problem.
Yeah, well, that's why I wrote my second book on this subject, The Public Bank Solution, which is all about models globally and historically.
Yeah, and you can still point to North Dakota before, you know, they were the last one standing before their the whole oil thing took off.
Yeah, 2009, right.
But they still, politics is politics. They're still going to say, you know, well, it's because of oil.
Yep.
Okay, well, you know what? This is just amazing. Would you do me a favor and send me that information on the person that you were talking about? Because for nothing else, even if it might not be my show, I am just fascinated.
Sure.
That this whole black market, I love reading about all that stuff. Because who knows? If there's something going on, I want to know it. And you know there's...
Right. And
go ahead.
Well, it just... There are so many fascinating things out there. I mean, it seems like it's a whole new ballgame with the internet where you can just learn all this stuff. There's an explosion of information.
But how much of it is real? You know, you look at it and go... But, you know, I was watching the stuff on aliens, and these people really seem legitimate. You know, I've never seen anything, but even President Carter said that he's seen an alien. Or seen a, you know,
a UFO.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Reagan said he saw one too. It's just bizarre. But they interview people who are really legitimate, people in the military and people that are, and if you talk to people in, Russia, it's open. they don't hide it. They, it's open. They all talk about it. And in France, it's open. All that stuff is open, but it's private here. It's weird.
Yeah, well, supposedly, according to Paul Hellyer, this was because Eisenhower, you know, made their, they wanted the technology, so they made a deal, and the ETs supposedly wanted it not to be known. And so that was the deal. But it all got in, you know, when Eisenhower said, beware the military-industrial complex, that was his parting shot.
Yeah.
According to Paul Hellyer, the reason he said that was that they had lost control of the extraterrestrial connection. I mean, they'd given it to the military-industrial complex to develop, and the military-industrial complex had run away with it. So it was no longer under government influence. So who knew who got all that technology? But, you know, there's a lot of amazing stuff that you figure. How did we human beings figure that out? Well, maybe we didn't. Maybe we got it from somewhere else.
Woohoo! It is really kind of fascinating. I mean, it makes, you know, well, when you listen to these people that claim that they saw this stuff and they're military people and they really, there's an astronaut that saw stuff too. And they all go on record and they're very serious. And then there's a governor from, Arizona that says that, you know, that big thing that happened in Arizona, and they kind of made fun of it and stuff. And then he came on record later and said, hey, this was real. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty, you've probably seen all that stuff too.
Yeah, I've seen a bit. I'm actually not an aficionado on this stuff, but it's an interesting explanation because who would be powerful enough to do all those things that we know are happening? You have to wonder. Maybe it's not us. Or you think, you know, how could people be so inhuman? And then you think,
exactly.
Oh, well, maybe they aren't human.
Well, so I kind of think, how come we don't stand up against some of this stuff? I don't understand. And why are we not bright enough to solve our problems? Why are we not, if the North Dakota banking system is so good, why can't we just get it done? And we're really struggling right now. This country is struggling. Jobs, kids are 50% underemployed in this country. You know, kids coming out of college. Our jobs are awful. Small businesses are struggling. We can't get loans. Why are we not solving these problems? And if we have a system that can solve it, why are we not doing it? And I think that makes me mad because I'm like, why? What the heck? What's this wall, this brick wall to helping people? Do we really want people to suffer and struggle in this country, or do we want to take care of people?
Or you look in Michigan, in Detroit, they are cutting off people's water because the people aren't paying for the water. Well, water is, if you don't have a job, how are you going to pay for the water, and where are they going to get the jobs? What do we have a government for if it's not to provide roads and water and credit and jobs?
Well, we're not going to provide basic things for people like water and healthcare.
But in a state like Michigan, which has plenty of water.
Well, okay, so we're not going to provide water. We're not going to do the things, but we're going to make sure those Wall Street banks get $1 trillion. You know, it's kind of like, come on, where is our value? And I'm pretty conservative fiscally. I'm not somebody who's out there to, you know, for the welfare state. But at some point, it becomes absolutely ridiculous when the people that you're helping and serving are the least, the people that need it the least. It's really kind of a sad scenario.
And it's the whole excuse or the whole argument is we can't do it because we don't have the money. But what is money? Why don't we? Money should be, we have a wrong conception of money. We think it's something you have to get from somewhere. You have to borrow it from somebody who's got it. You got to borrow it from somebody who dug the gold out of the ground. But really, money is just a medium of exchange. So why can't we just say, well, we need roads and bridges and water and all these things. So we're going to hire people to do it. And we acknowledge that they've done work for the community. So we're going to pay them with these little pieces paper, and then they can trade those little pieces of paper with other people who've done work. And if there are too many pieces of paper out there, then we'll start taxing them back. My ideal way of getting the money back is let the government go into a couple of businesses. One business might be banking. let the government be the bank, and they will get all that in the way of interest. You could actually eliminate income taxes if you nationalize the whole banking system. I know that's not going to happen anytime soon, but that's what happened in Pennsylvania in Benjamin Franklin's day, and they had no taxes.
Well, they just got stuff done back then. Why can't we just get it done? And that gets to the same point. How can we care so little? But you know what? Back in the Roman days and everything else, they cared pretty little about the poor as well. Remember, the poor weren't even valued as people practically. And I think we value them more now than we used to, or maybe we don't. I don't know, but I don't know if that's a human condition or not, but I don't understand. I would think that we'd want prosperity and to live in a great country. We have the resources to be a great country. Why the heck can't we be? And your solution is something that can help us be great. What is the deal? Get off our butts, politicians. Learn it, understand it, and get it done. People need it. So,
right.
Okay.
Well, I think Minnesota would be a great place to start, or you know, it's a little like North Dakota. You're kind of,
we are, and you know what?
You could get away with it, and maybe nobody would notice.
We could like fly under the radar. Interviewed Mike McFadden yesterday, and we're gonna have him on. It's gonna go live on Monday. He's the Republican candidate for Senate, and uh-huh. He's a smart guy. He's an investment banker, and I don't know, but I don't think he's an investment banker in the same way that he's not a Wall Street investment banker. Of course, they want to make him out to be that to make him seem like he's an evil person. But he's more about buying and selling businesses and working in the trenches with businesses. And I think if he got elected, you know, maybe he could help get something like this going. I don't know. Because if it could help our state to the level that it's helped North Dakota, I don't know why we wouldn't do it. So
yeah, North Dakota is a very Republican conservative state. It's not socialist. It's about state sovereignty, which is a Republican value. Like, we want our own revenues for our own purposes. We don't want to give them away.
Exactly. Well, you know what? Thank you so much. And it was an interesting conversation. And I know the aliens were a little bit off track, but who isn't interested in some of that stuff, right? I mean, we're not experts.
I was only thinking about it because it was part of the book of the man I was going to interview today.
That's so funny. And you have to laugh because it's one of those things that everybody's fascinated about. But
yeah.
And if you haven't read
it. But you don't talk about it.
Well, yeah. You don't talk about it because you look like an idiot. But it's funny and it's fun to talk about. Okay. Well, good. Well, thank you so much, Ellen, and I really appreciate it. You know what? I might ask you back at some later time if you're willing.
Sure. I love your enthusiasm. Thanks, Sarah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Nice talking to you. Have a great day.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah, bye.
As you can see, Ellen Brown is a pretty smart lady. You kind of got to ignore the alien part because although I got to tell you, I'm really fascinated with aliens because you got to admit the structures in Egypt and those pyramids and all these things. There's a question out there. Who knows what's really going on? But it's always fascinating to talk about that. And we were laughing and having a good time. And especially offline, we were laughing a little bit about it. But the public banking solution is serious. And it's something that our country really should look at. There's so much politics out there. And the big banks are the ones that are going to fight this. The Federal Reserve is going to fight this. I don't know why the Federal Reserve would fight it like they will, because it really is what our country needs. Well, I guess I do know why they're going to fight it, because it's a private bank, and the people who make money off the Federal Reserve do not want it because they're not going to make as much money. But the people of this country will be better off for doing a different system. So our lawmakers should be looking at solutions that really help the people, not line the pockets of private corporations. Okay, enough off my soapbox. The next segment, this is our Gear Up for 2015 segment, and this is the flex wage solution that I talked about at the beginning. And as you'll see, this is an interesting solution for not only helping the employees, but this also helps cut down the cost of payroll in general. So I think for businesses that are looking for solutions to help their employees without incurring additional costs and actually maybe saving money, this is it. This is a great solution. So now we're going to welcome the CEO of FlexWage.
Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really glad you came today because you have a really unique, I don't know how, I think it's pretty unique, and I think you would say it's pretty unique business that you do, and I think it helps a lot of people. And I'm really excited about anything that can help a lot of people in business. What does your company do?
So FlexWage, we've developed and patented a system we call WageBank. And what it does is replace the need for short-term lending for the lower and middle income marketplace. And it's provided as an employer-based benefit. And effectively what it does is interfaces with the employer's payroll and time and attendance systems. And that allows us to track and value the labor their employees have worked within the pay cycle. And when they need short-term capital, bridge capital to help them through to the next paycheck, they're able to access their own earnings at a very low flat rate fee instead of going to third-party lenders and paying, you know, what are, you know, typically fairly egregious fees for the pleasure.
So, well, how specifically does it work?
So the employee has access to what we call WageBank, and they can access it through their mobile device, through the web, or, you know, kind of lowest common denominator on a payphone through an IVR. And they can basically come into the system and see or hear how much they've accumulated net of taxes, withholdings, and other deductions during that pay cycle, and on a managed basis governed by a set of policies with the employer, they're able to access that money immediately, paid to their debit card, and literally it's a sub-5-second transaction, and they have good funds to take care of whatever, you know, financial need they had at that time.
So basically, if they've worked for 3 days, they get 3 days of their wages.
Yeah, absolutely. It's 3 days minus whatever the, you know, kind of calculated deductions and so forth would be.
What they would normally get on their paycheck.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a pretty great tool for people. Well, what does it replace?
So it really it replaces the kind of what they consider the alternative financial services. And, you know, that would be like, you know, payday lending, which is a $42 billion industry last year, bounce checks at banks, so NSF fees, which was $32 billion in expenses last year.
Oh, that's awful. I don't like it when banks are making money off fees. Anyways, keep going.
Indeed, and it's, you know, this is the market segment that can least afford to pay, overpriced fees for these type of services. But then you have, you know, title lending and other things like check cashing and so forth. Again, it's kind of this whole, it's almost a $200 billion industry called alternative financial services that's geared towards this market segment. And again, it's, you know, the
does old that include pawn shops and short-term lending where it's 2,000% interest rates, or what are the ridiculous interest rates those people pay?
Yeah, so unfortunately, you know, they probably range from 500% to, like you said, 2,000%. And again, it's kind of that whole short-term lending industry that's, you know, there's been a lot of focus on it lately, which is good for us, because we do have, you know, I guess what you call the white knight solution to, you know, to the problem. And, you know, as everyone has come to understand, you can't regulate demand, and there's this, you know, there's specifically a huge need in the marketplace for this short-term liquidity. And, you know, we believe we have the best solution to that. You know, by eliminating risk, we've taken away the big cost driver on the equation. And by leveraging the employer as the distribution channel, we've kind of mitigated the second largest cost of that short-term lending equation, which is customer acquisition.
So why would an employer offer WageBank's solution?
So there's really two, tracks of benefit for the employer. The first is financially. You know, a lot of these employees currently get paper checks, and paper checks are very expensive and somewhat painful for the employers to deal with. And because of the immediacy of the funding on WageBank, obviously that can't be on a paper check. So it really promotes the adoption of electronic pay. And, you know, part and parcel or kind of connected with WageBank is the availability of a payroll card for these employees. And again, that also helps them avoid the check cashers and a bunch of the other...
Do employers actually save money with this process?
They do, actually.
Wow, you know, that's really interesting.
Indeed, and that's you know, kind of the beauty of the equation and the value proposition to the employer is they're able to offer this massive benefit to their employee, and in doing so, actually save money. And then on the soft side for the employer, you know, you have the impact of the financial stress associated with these short-term loans. You know, that impacts the employee's productivity, their absenteeism, their job satisfaction, and ultimately, you know, the retention of those employees.
Well, I think so, anybody that's managed or that has in their company low income earners, you know, factory workers, people that work in service jobs, it's pretty apparent that they need something like this. Or that,
absolutely,
you know, they use these services. It's just they pay a lot for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with the financial turn we've had over the last 5 years,
it's
exacerbated the problem. And there's been a lot of really good studies, and actually SHRM, which is the Society of Human Resources Management, they just produced a study that shows the incidence and the frequency and the pervasiveness of this short-term capital need for employees.
Well, if the market, what is it, a $200 billion market? Now, is that the United States market?
Yeah, that's simply in the U.S.
Wow, okay. That's huge. Wonder why people are getting into it. You know, you just don't hear about it that often. It's amazing how big that is. Well, what are you hearing feedback-wise from employees?
So, you know, employees love it. You know, they've been through the stress and the anguish of dealing with, you know, other forms of short-term liquidity. And being able to do this, you know, literally on their phone, and a large majority of this market segment is mobile, you know, smartphone enabled. They may not have a PC or a laptop at home with Wi-Fi, but, you know, over 90% are smartphone capable, and they like to use that smartphone for everything. So, you know, having the mobile apps where they have the ability to go on and see how much they've accrued, you know, see how they are against their policies with their company relative to how frequently they can access WageBank, you know, it gives them that financial empowerment that most of us take for granted, you know, having online checking and so forth. So it's you know, it's kind of got this twofold benefit for the employee, one in just, you know, the reality of saving them a ton of money from these other alternatives, but then it's that whole financial empowerment of now they have a card, they have a Visa or MasterCard branded card, they can shop with that card, they can go on Amazon and make orders now.
Well, it's money, right? I mean, it's a credit card. I would think the stress factor alone would be worth it. Just the peace of mind of having, you know, anybody that runs a business knows what cash flow is, and so these people that are living paycheck to paycheck, it probably really helps them. Obviously, if they're living paycheck to paycheck all the time, then they probably need some bigger, you know, some bigger planning and some help. But what do regulators think of this?
So we've made a, you know, very distinct point to be proactive in, you know, going out and meeting with the regulators, explaining what WageBank is and how it works. And we've had an overwhelmingly supportive response. You know, I'd say unanimously they believe that we have a much more beneficial solution for the consumers. And in fact, with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, we're working with their Project Catalyst team to identify and launch a couple of studies with employers that will allow us to really demonstrate numerically the, you know, kind of the great impact of this, you know, really beneficial product.
So you're working
consumers.
So you're working to quantify it and come up with stats,
yeah,
figures,
absolutely,
and proof. This is proof that this is better for them. Well, it's kind of obvious that a 2,000% interest rate, 500% interest rate is not too good. Okay, so what drove you to create this business? We just shortly, quickly, because we don't have much time left, but what drove you to create this business?
It was really, I had my first exposure to this LMI or lower middle income marketplace while I ran the commercial card business at JP Morgan. And I just fell in love with the thought of having a product that's socially responsible but has a sustainable long-term business model. And, you know, really, there was a bunch of my previous experiences in automating and process management and financial services that all kind of conspired to come together and, you know, allow us to create something that was going to be truly unique and have a, you know, hopefully a massive social impact while making a little money along the way.
Makes you feel good to do something good, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, it sounds like a win-win-win for everyone. So good job. Thank you very much for coming onto the show.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
And if I can get your contact information so I can have it up on the page, the radio page?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Frank. Great job.
As you can see, FlexWage is a really good program for providing employees a benefit without incurring additional costs or maybe even saving money. And in today's world, what is better than providing a means for removing employee turnover and helping your employees out without incurring a cost? I mean, we can't afford to incur a cost, but we really need to take care of our people because our companies are our people, right? We need them to do the work. We need them to be happy and we need them to be secure because the last thing that we need is to lose our best employees. So this is a great way to help them out. It removes stressors. It does a lot of good things. So if you want more information from FlexWage, look on our radio page and we will also have ways to contact Ellen Brown as well. So that's it for now. Have a great day.